This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Several years ago, the Vermont Legislative Council said Vermont was falling far short of what it needed to spend to keep our transportation infrastructure sound. In fact, Vermont ranked 48th among U.S. states for the conditions of roads and bridges. 36% of bridges were deemed structurally deficient. But by 2013, that number had been whittled down to 8%. The state also lowered the percentage of paved roads in poor condition from 36% in 2008 to 21% in 2013. An influx of money made all of the difference. Federal funds designed to help boost states out of the Great Recession went directly to transportation, and more federal and state dollars came rolling in after Tropical Storm Irene. But now there's a lot of uncertainty surrounding transportation funding. On the state level, there's a growing shortfall, and while the future of federal funding is unclear, it is certain that Vermont won't be receiving as much as it has in the past. So how do we keep our transportation infrastructure in good shape? Is it just about finding the money to repave and rebuild? Or are there more innovative ways to rethink transportation? We're going to ask those questions today, and we're joined now by the chairs of the House and Senate Transportation Committees, Representative Pat Brennan and Senator Dick Mazza. Welcome to both of you. Nice to have you here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So if we've run out of funding from Irene recovery, and we're not getting those ERA funds from the federal government that were designed to help shovel-ready projects in states get to the shovel portion, you know, get that shovel in the ground. If both of those funds are no longer coming to us, how much money does that actually take out of what we can spend on transportation? Representative Brennan?
Well, in this fiscal year 2016 budget, we are looking at probably most likely a downgrade of about $50 million in comparison to what we had the last couple of years. And those were banner years.
If we were struggling before those years to keep our bridges structurally sound and to keep paved roads in good condition, are we now back in a place where we can't maintain our transportation infrastructure, Senator Mazza?
Well, it's too early to make a decision on that. Certainly, everything has to deal with money. Whatever we do, it's how much money you spend. For example, last year we did $117 million in paving, so we're able to make progress. If we drop that this year to roughly $100 million, we're going to fall behind a little bit. But, you know, we can't control the funding. That's something we all work with and try to do the best you can with money you have. But other than raise taxes, there's no other revenues if the federal government, they play a big role. And as you know, gasoline consumption is down. So those are some of the items.
But does the fact that we had been seeing a lot of problems in trying to keep our infrastructure in good shape before we had that money, and now that money is gone. I mean, are our needs outpacing our ability to fund them when it comes to roads and bridges? Representative Brennan.
No, I wouldn't say that. I'd say the influx of ERA funding and Irene funds that have come in over the past 3 or 4 years have helped us get caught up to where we should be. We at one time had a target of achieving a 25% condition of pavement in Vermont. Acceptable level would have been 25%.
And you're better than that.
We're better than that. We're at 13. So we've come a long way, and I think our main focus is right now is to try to maintain what we've achieved over the past few years.
I might add that this is an issue that's affecting every state in the nation. It's not just a Vermont issue.
Sure.
The uncertainty of federal funds, and as you know, the president has said many times, the infrastructure throughout the country needs millions and billions of dollars. So everyone is struggling with this.
You're also looking at what is projected to be about an $8 million budget shortfall because the price of gas has gone down. Representative Brennan, can you explain this assessment that in Vermont is tied to the price of gas?
Yes. Currently, we're looking in this budget at a $6.6 million shortfall, and that is attributable to the fact that we have a special tax assessment. We call it the TIB fund. It's a transportation infrastructure bond fund, it allows us to bond for projects. It also funds any project with any deal of longevity, 30 years or more, like, for instance, rail, bridges, structures. So in that fund, we collect a 2% assessment from the wholesalers. Now, this did not have a floor on it, and back when we first established it, it was only pulling in around 14 to 16 million a year. But when gas prices got high, it I think we were, combination of gas and diesel were pulling in around 22 million. That, to me, is what allowed us to gain ground on our structures and our bridges and our pavement and bring them down to acceptable levels. Currently, with gas prices as low as they are, this 2% assessment does not have a floor on it, so it's unprotected by low gas prices. That's where the $6.6 million in revenue shortfall comes from.
Right, so while low gas prices are good for consumers, it's not good for state coffers when it comes to being able to fund bridge repairs and long-term repairs in transportation infrastructure.
Exactly, and I should mention with that, gasoline consumption over since 2009 when we put this assessment in place has dropped by about 28 million gallons. At one time in Vermont, we were consuming about 376 million gallons, I should say, of gasoline per year, and we're down to about 307 right now.
We're talking today about roads and bridges, specifically how to pay for them, and we're speaking with the House and Senate Transportation Committee chairs. Listeners, we want to know what you think. Are you willing to pay more at the pump? Are you willing to pay more in taxes to have good roads? We hear from so many of you all the time, especially at this time of year, about how terrible the roads are. That's part of living in Vermont. But what would you do, what would you pay to make it acceptable to have good roads? We're looking at that today, and if you want to chime in, our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. All right, so that assessment that we just mentioned that helps fund long-term projects like bridge repair, that is tied to the price of gas because it has no floor, so it really fluctuates with the price of gas. A couple of years ago with the Vermont gas tax, we changed the way that that's set. And so now there's a formula that sets a base rate of 12 cents, regardless of the price of gas. On top of that is a 4% tax on the retail price of gas. And to prevent revenues from falling too low when gas prices go down, the 4% can go no lower than 4% of $3.87 a gallon. Do I have that right, Representative Brennan?
Okay. Right. Very good.
In other words, even at the current...
Would you like to join our committee?
Good, yes, I'm in.
You can help us a lot.
So, you know, it basically for people who are now swimming in numbers, you know, what that means is that even if your gas price at the pump right now is about, you know, $2.50, $2.60 a gallon, that 4% that's part of the gas tax is based on a $3.87 a gallon gas price. So you're basically paying a 4% of $3.87. It also does have a ceiling, so that if gas ever went above $5.09, you wouldn't be paying more than 4% on that.
At 3.87, we thought that was, the norm. And then the good news is it's down to 2.50. Whoever thought it was going to happen within 6 months, then that's great news for people buying gas. But when you're looking at it for revenue, it's not as good.
So that was a surprise to you, Senator Mazza, that gas prices went so far down.
Sure. I mean, and everyone, it was a surprise. Even the trucking industry, we mustn't forget diesel. The trucking industry has been benefiting from this. And even car dealers, thank goodness we have car sales have been very good. Car dealers have done very well in selling new cars because people are purchasing vehicles again today, assuming that they can save $50, $60 a week on fuel. So it's been very good. So our revenues on car sales, on purchase and use taxes, has been very good. But gasoline tax, can't have it both ways, I guess.
But given that the state did put in this formula where there's that base rate of 12 cents and then that 4% that's based on $3.87 a gallon, which is, as we've established, much higher than the price that people are paying, why isn't that enough? If people are already paying, you know, a pretty high set price for the gas tax, why isn't that enough to fund what we need to fund, Representative Brennan?
Well, you know, it's enough to fund what we've been doing in the past. And I should go back and say, actually, it doesn't fully enable us to do what needed to be done. We have suffered over the, going back about 5 years and 10 years before that, we suffered from deferred maintenance for a few years, and we didn't always put the money into transportation projects that we should have, or we didn't have it to put into transportation projects. So we had a lot of catching up to do, as the numbers you put out earlier allude to. But, yeah, given the fact that, you know, the prices are what they are, and with the floor protection we have, we're making do with what we have, and it's tough to fill a shortfall like we have 6.6 on the TIB. We I should mention,
and the TIB again, that's the one, that's that assessment that is tied to the price of gasoline that funds the long-term repairs, the TIB,
the 2%. Yep. And so we use that to the best of our ability, and we came up about $6.6 million short, and we basically found some internal savings. We scrubbed the books and came up with about $4.5 million of internal savings, some labor costs, some moving around of money, some cash reserves left over from last year, and that basically left us short about $2 million. So we do have to make a few cuts.
So I want to talk in more depth about what you're going to do next, how we actually fund the transportation budget. But just let me lay out one other piece of this issue here in terms of figuring out how Vermont is going to, you know, what the funding mechanism is, how much money Vermont's going to get, and then we'll get into what you plan to do about it. But one more piece of the puzzle here, the Federal Highway Trust Fund is due to run out of money at the end of May. Congress could maintain the fund in the short term, which would provide Vermont with as much money as it's currently getting. But the fund is going to need a long-term solution. And everyone pretty much believes that Vermont will end up receiving less money in the future than it has been getting from the Federal Highway Trust Fund so far. 60%, as I understand it, of our transportation budget comes from federal funding. So, Senator Mazza, is this a crisis for Vermont?
Well, like I said, I think it's facing a lot of states, Vermont in particular, because we've done very well under the federal bill. One of the other issues—
I think most states only get about 20% of their budget from the federal government, and we're more like 60.
We get $2 on a dollar we send in.
I think we get $3 for every dollar we send in.
So we've done very well under the present, but I don't think that's going to happen in the future. One of the things that bothers me is a concern about more electric vehicles, more hybrids. Now, those are good things for the pollution of the air. The other thing is, you know, they're not paying any gasoline tax. The other item is natural gas and propane for trucks. Our industry is growing. UPS, I understand, just bought, not for Vermont, but I think nationwide, about 1,500 trucks that will be running on liquefied natural gas. So every time that happens, we've got to figure out how to contend with this. Gasoline, cars are going to get better mileage, no doubt about that. They're going to consume less, but also electric vehicles and hybrids are how do we tax it? How do we tax them for the service of the highways? And like I said, natural gas and trucks, because it is a growing business. People want cleaner emissions, and so coast to coast, they're building about 1,500 stations this year for natural gas for trucks. So that's a concern everybody has.
What about you, Representative Brennan? Concerns? Crisis?
Well, yes, we have, you know, our committee and the agency, I'm sure, have great concerns over the uncertainty of a federal reauthorization, and the chances are very good that we won't do as well. We are up against large states who, for every dollar they put in, get 80 cents back, 70 cents back. So they are concerned. They're going to be working hard for that. We're lucky to have a congressional delegation that understands our problem here in Vermont, and I'm sure they'll be working hard to make sure that we do as well, or, you know, close to as good as we're doing now. And hopefully that remains the same. But I should mention, too, that we are doing fairly well now when we don't reauthorize with a long-term plan. We are living off past budgets. We had a big slug of Jefford earmark money in the past, and every time we do not reauthorize long term, we go with a continuing resolution that gets us the monies that we have been getting right along. If that goes away with reauthorization, those monies are at risk.
And this is, of course, Jim Jeffords, who actually had a big chunk of money that he got put into Vermont coffers.
He did. He had
those were the old days.
Yeah. Those were the old days when he had earmarks.
I agree. I think earmarks should have been done away with because it was unfair from everyone. It all depends who you were, where you were. And I'd really take that money and distribute it equally if that's the case. And no state stands out with a big earmark, whether it's $10 million. But we were fortunate, so you take the money when you can get it. But I think in the long run, it's better not to have earmarks.
All right, this is Vermont Edition. Today we're talking about roads and bridges. We're looking at how to pay for them. We've sort of set up what the issues are here, where the money's coming from or not coming from, as the case may be. When we come back from the break, we're going to talk a little bit with Senator Mazza and Representative Brennan about what they plan to do, what they're thinking could work for Vermont short-term and long-term. And we have a lot of listeners who want to weigh in on this as well, including a note from Stephen about those electric-powered vehicles. What's going to happen? Will they have to pay something towards the gas tax? We'll look at those kinds of options. And if you want to chime in, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Representative Pat Brennan is chair of the House Transportation Committee. Senator Dick Mazza is chair of the Senate Transportation Committee. Together, they're helping us understand how the legislature is trying to balance the cost of road and bridge repair with budget constraints and a limited appetite for new taxes. If you have an idea or a question for them, you can call 1-800-639-2211. It's 1-800-639-2211, or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. You willing to pay a couple extra cents on the dollar for every gallon of gasoline right now while the prices are low? What do you think would work? All right, we got a note from John who says, I live on Social Security, yet I use our roads, so I feel responsible to help pay for repairs and maintenance. I always have been in favor of raising the gas tax. We as citizens need to step up to the plate and pay for what we use. Bill says, with a $1.50 or so drop in the price of gasoline, there couldn't be a less painful time to raise the gas tax to properly fund road and bridge repair. How much of a gas tax increase would get the job done? Vermont roads are in need of serious work. All right, Representative Brennan, two people who say, go ahead, raise the gas tax right now. Is that something on the table?
Not at this time. I would say that to get to where we need to be, what would it take? I don't think they'd be interested in how much of an increase that would be.
How much would it be?
Well, I can't really put an exact figure on it, but I mean, we are to fix all our roads and bridges all at once and bring them up to snuff to where they should be. You would hypothetically 40 cents a gallon, or you know, it's astronomical. We have made good progress to this point, and to bring our roads and our structures and infrastructure down to where it's at an acceptable level. We continue to chip away at it. But at this time, I would like to see us stop the bleeding, per se, on the infrastructure bond fund side of the gas tax. But there wasn't much of an appetite for that, so we didn't go there. What we did was I'm talking about putting a floor on the TIB such that would recapture the $6.6 million in lost revenue.
In other words, do the same thing that you have with the gas tax.
The same exact floor, and that would basically equate to about a 2.5-cent increase.
But that's not going to happen.
That is not going to happen. What we are proposing is to put a floor in according to current prices of the average revenue forecast at $249, which would generate no new revenue, but would also ensure that we do not lose revenues if prices go down.
All right. So that's one thing that you're hoping to do is put that floor on it. So if prices continue to go down, although, you know, it doesn't sound like they're going to go down that much more. So you're still at a pretty low floor there.
We're at the current, average price per gallon. But, you know, if it were to go down to 2.25, I mean, it doesn't take much to lose revenue. So for every drop in gas prices, that fund would bleed out a little more.
I can tell you the future of gasoline taxes is getting less and less every year. We know probably in 10 years from now, there'll be other ways of funding transportation. It will not be gas tax because it is a dwindling revenue source. So, and people across the country know that. So you'd have to keep raising gas tax quite a bit to make up some of the differences, because gasoline is going to decline. Better gas mileage, hybrids, electric vehicles certainly are going to take over.
Let's go to Josh calling in from Richmond. Hi, Josh. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. In fact, you just led into what I wanted to say, which is we really need to replace the gas tax with something like, this is what I'm going to suggest, a mileage fee based on the number of miles that everybody drives. It would apply equally to gasoline-powered cars, electric cars, cars that get good mileage, cars that get bad mileage. We already have in our car a device called an odometer that records the mileage you drive every year. And when your car's inspected, one of the things that gets put on the form is the mileage at that time. So it seems to me the state could incorporate something into your registration fee based on that odometer reading that says you owe so many dollars for the miles that you've driven. So that's my suggestion. The governor once said that this would be difficult to implement because it would be an invasion of people's privacy, but there's no invasion of privacy recording my mileage. It's already being recorded. So,
Josh,
thanks for the call.
I appreciate that.
I'll listen on the radio.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I'll point out another issue with that, and Representative Brennan, maybe you can address them, is there's no way to tell which state those miles were driven in. If you've got people who, you know, drive across the country, how do you determine which roads they're using, or does that even matter? Any possibility of something like what Josh is considering?
There is a possibility, but, Jane, I was raising the hand to talk on that one, because actually it's very complicated, and to make it work, you'd almost need a regional compact. Try
Senator Mazza's raising his hand on that.
Yeah,
saying,
all of the New England states would
amen.
Have to be on
or
board.
Or nationwide.
Yeah, or nationwide. Yeah, and we're kind of waiting for the feds to do something there too. If you were traveling out of state, you've got an issue there. If you had, we have a great deal of tourism in Vermont, and how do we capture those user miles in Vermont? So to make it actually work, you'd have to have a multi-state compact.
Okay, and is that likely? I mean, if Senator Mazza said, look, the gas tax is going to go away, so is something like a regional or national compact likely to happen?
It would have to.
Everybody's talking on a national level about mileage tax. It is being discussed. It's just how to implement it and how to do it. So, you know, you do have the privacy issue, and you've got a who checks the mileage, who confirms your mileage, who hands it in. What, you know, it's not as easy. We inspect our cars today, but they write down a mileage. Doesn't mean it's not documented as a fact for anything. They don't really care how many miles you drive your car if you inspect your car. So, but this would have some bearing. Okay, I drove 8,000 miles. Now I'm paying a nickel a gallon or a nickel a mile or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. So you better have some accuracy here.
We did get a note from Stephen, and I'm going to direct this to you, Senator Mazza, because you were bringing it up before the break. Stephen wants to know if electric-powered vehicles, which of course use the same roads, will have to pay something towards the gas tax.
Well, that's what we're trying to figure out now. How do you do that fairly? Because they're paying the same registration fee as gasoline vehicles, yet to get the benefit of the highway. So there are those who say, okay, I'm using an electric vehicle and I'm keeping the air cleaner, which certainly is a good argument. On the other hand, you're doing the same damage to the highway as a car with gasoline. So how do you balance that out? Do you charge them $20 more for registration, or we haven't got to that point yet?
We got a note from Jordan who says, you end up paying to repair your vehicle from the damage caused by the rough roads, so we pay either way. I say raise the tax and fix the roads. And Tim in Heartland writes, since most of our roads are destroyed by winter's end, I wonder if a tax could be in place for the out-of-state ski traffic that utilizes our system of transportation and bring money into the system without touching Vermont wallets.
Talk about discrimination. How would you enforce that one? Let me tell you, that's a tough one. No, you want to encourage people to come to Vermont and spend their money. I don't think we want to discourage them.
No, I agree.
Let's go to Marshall, who's calling in from Heartland. Hi, Marshall. Go ahead.
Hello. So it seems to me that a lot of the road damage is caused by weather, by freezing and thawing. I've traveled around the country and around the world and taken specific note of the quality of the roads. And Vermont roads get hit pretty hard. I'm wondering if anybody has quantified the amount of additional expense that's caused due to damage to the road surface by the application of salt, which is something that most places don't do, or don't do very much.
Thanks for the call, Marshall. Senator Massa?
We get criticized for not using enough salt. You know, this is wintertime in Vermont is very challenging, and if you use sand, we get criticized for that. But salt, we use salt, and people say you don't use enough. Some people say you use too much. When you're in a climate such as this, that's the choice you have these days. You either run salt or sand if you're going to have somewhat highways that are safe because, like I said, the criticism is always we want bare roads. Well, that's not going to happen.
Bare roads when it's icy and snowy.
Right.
Yeah.
And we have to drive road conditions. But there's no other alternative out there that I know of at this point.
We have a note from Richard in Dorset who says, wasn't the gas tax raised only 2 years ago because of the shortfall in the transportation budget? Most people accepted it, understanding we need to keep our roads maintained. Now we're being asked to pay more. The state has underestimated revenues for the last 5 years. It's time to set priorities and work within our means. In the short term, Representative Brennan, are there projects that you can put your finger on now that you think are going to be postponed, delayed, canceled outright that we would be doing if we had a fully funded transportation budget and enough money to actually, you know, keep pace at repairing our roads and bridges?
No, I wouldn't say so. At this point right now, our budget is built on $630 million. Now, we had to deal with a $6.6 million shortfall, so we addressed that with internal savings to the tune of $4.5 million, which left us about $2 million short. So of that $2 million, we have cut some leveling projects in our budget. This isn't a final budget. It has to pass the Senate and both bodies. But it does about a $1.5 million cut in leveling, which is a district leveling paving project. It's about $100,000 a mile. So it affects about 15 statewide miles. And it doesn't seem like a lot, but it's 2 miles here, 3 miles there in districts that are sorely in need of a quick fix. Not a big hit to that, but large enough so it'll have some effect. And the rest of the savings are captured in revenue savings from low fuel prices in the maintenance budget. So we didn't hit our budget that hard with these cuts. And there are no projects that will be delayed. I should mention some of these dollars leverage federal money. What we do there, this $2 million will leverage about $8 million in federal contributions. We do not lose that money. It is delayed by project delays such as right-of-way issues and stuff like that. No project will be canceled, but just delayed till next year, and the federal money hangs out for us there.
Well, with that federal money being in question, you know, what's going to happen with the Federal Highway Transportation Fund? How does that affect how, in your committees, you try to think about budgeting when you don't know what the feds are going to do? Senator Massa?
Well, I think this year, like I said, if they don't have an agreement by May, they'll extend the existing one. So I think we're going into this year fairly good shape, but because they don't stop funding completely, but it'd be a concern for next year.
And long term, Representative Brennan, do we need to come up with a totally different model? I mean, you're sort of skating along this year with an idea of where the federal funds are going to be, a way to, you know, patch up the budget based on postponing a few projects and, you know, saving some money on gas in the fleet. But long term, do we need a major change to how we fund transportation projects?
Yes, I would say long-term, when we do see what the federal reauthorization is going to be, when we see it, I'm sure it's not going to be what we would like to see, and we are going to have to readjust the way we do business and look at the revenue package. We actually, in our bill, have a transportation revenue study that we asked for this summer to look for alternative ways to fund transportation.
And you agree, Senator Massa?
Yeah, that's the only way we can do it at this point. We're faced with that decision, and we've got to do it's a work in progress.
All right. Well, we'll continue to look at it. A lot of innovative, interesting ideas coming from our listeners, so I'm sure we'll address this topic again. But thanks to both of you for helping us understand what's going to happen in the short term here with the transportation budget. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Representative Pat Brennan, chair of the House Transportation Committee, and Senator Dick Massa, chair of the Senate Transportation Committee. Coming up, Boy Meets Girl. We'll talk with a filmmaker from Vermont who's exploring classic themes from a new angle. His latest film has a transgender woman woman who'd never acted before as its protagonist. Stay tuned, you're listening to Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The film Boy Meets Girl centers around a young woman in Kentucky named Ricky. She meets a beautiful young woman named Francesca, who's just arrived in town. In this scene from the movie, Francesca and Ricky are sitting on the bank of a local creek while Robbie, Ricky's friend, is cooling off in the water. Francesca asks Ricky about him.
He's cute. Is he your boyfriend?
No, we've been best friends since like first grade. He works in my dad's garage.
Well, and nothing ever happened? Not even once?
No, he doesn't like...
Like...
Girls like me.
Girls like you. Okay, what's not to like about you? You're gorgeous, funny, smart.
Well, thank you. But he,
Tell her! Tell her!
Drown, you loser!
Hypocrite!
I swear on my mother I will swim out there and drown you myself if you don't shut it.
I'm just saying!
Robbie is alluding to a secret that Ricky hasn't yet revealed to her new friend. That secret and the relationship that develops between these three characters is at the heart of Boy Meets Girl. The film's director, Eric Schaefer, lives part-time in Vermont and filmed much of the movie there. He describes the plot this way.
Boy Meets Girl focuses on Ricky, who's a 22-year-old transgender girl living in Kentucky, and her best friend, Robbie, who's a cisgender boy. And they've been friends their whole life, since they're little kids. And, you know, while she gets tremendous support from her family and her community about being a transgender woman, Robbie is certainly her closest confidant, and they've always been platonic. During the arc of the film, certain things happen, and Ricky sort of meets a cisgender woman named Francesca and starts to experiment with a lesbian relationship, and that sort of makes Robbie go through some feelings that he might not have been aware he had for Ricky. So that's sort of the plot of the movie, is it's about people who are trying to identify their innermost desires and longings and wishes that might be different than the box and compartment that society put them in terms of what they felt they were allowed or appropriate feelings or desires for their sexual orientation, their gender.
It's interesting to hear you talk about it like that because obviously, yes, it is about the boxes that we think people belong in. When you have a character who is very outspoken and open about the fact that she is a transgender woman. But the title of the movie, Boy Meets Girl, the movie itself, is in a lot of ways a really traditional love story. You know, two friends who've been friends for a long time and then have to explore whether they have romantic feelings for one another and how that's going to work for them.
That's why I titled it Boy Meets Girl. I wanted it to be the most sort of cliche, fabulistic, obvious title that we have in our culture for describing the regular old boy meets girl love story, because that's what this movie is at its heart. But clearly there's kind of a new exploration of the subject matter in that the heroine, you know, the lead girl, is a transgender girl. So I wanted the film to fire on many very familiar cylinders so that it would invite audiences. Listen, LGBTQ audiences, very liberal audiences, audiences that have transgender people in their lives as friends, as family. Those people, I'm singing to the choir or whatever that saying is. Mm-hmm. Singing to the preacher, preaching to the choir.
There we go.
Whatever they're in. But for those folks that might not be as privy or sort of aware of these issues, I wanted them to feel invited in a way that they could identify with the story from the get-go because it was very familiar to them. And that way they could be more open to the ideas expressed in the film.
Have you heard reaction from people who have seen the movie who perhaps aren't as sort of steeped in the LGBT world as that choir that you're talking about is?
So I was in San Diego, and my uncle, who is self-proclaimed, very conservative, ex-cop of many years, and I don't know him that well. I've met him maybe twice in my life. A man in his 50s, late 50s, early 60s, came up to me, and he couldn't be lying because I could visibly see in his eyes the excitement and the genuine nature of his feelings, and they were almost tears in his eyes. And he said, he went a far way to disclaim that he is not somebody that likes necessarily these kinds of movies, and he's straight as straight can be, and he's conservative, and he's Republican, and, you know, he said, I love this movie. I cried. And it wasn't just because I was his family, you know. Luckily, there haven't been that many kind of reactions because most people aren't so far right and Republican and conservative that have seen it. But I will say that obviously those are the most gratifying responses that I get, because those are people who might feel predisposed not only not be open to and identify and like a movie like this, but certainly not love it. And so when those people tell me that they have sort of emotions about the film that are positive, that's obviously, you know, super, super gratifying.
Can you tell me a little bit about how you cast the role of Ricky? It's played by Michelle Hendley, who is a transgender actor, and that's not something that we often see even in roles where a transgender character is featured. Jared Leto in the Dallas Buyers Club played a transgender woman. Jeffrey Tambor has been making waves for his portrayal of a woman in Transparent. Michelle Hendley is a transgender person.
As you say, traditionally, there are not a lot of avenues to find transgender actors. You know, there are a few very famous ones like Laverne Cox, and, you know, she wasn't appropriate for that role. So I had to get creative. So I Googled transgender actor, transgender actress, transgender woman, and went down the various cracks in the cement that doing research on the internet leads you to, and ended up on this YouTube channel of this really beautiful 22-year-old girl living in Missouri named Michelle Hendley, who had all these vlogs about her life and boys, and very personal, very intimate about her fashion interests and her Super Mario Brothers Halloween outfit. I mean, very adorable, very cute, very personal. So I got in touch with her and said, listen, I'm a movie director and writer and producer, and would you like to audition for my new film? And she, you know, understandably was dubious because she didn't know my work. So she was like, who is this guy? And I said, you know, look me up on IMDb, put your dad on the phone, like whatever you need to do to vet me, do it. And she did, and very quickly realized it was a completely legitimate film I was talking about. But she never acted in her life, and she was in cosmetology school in Columbia, Missouri. So I started rehearsing with her over Skype, and she got better and better. Then I flew her to New York to workshop the entire script with professional actors. I mean, I put her through the trials, I mean, because she was starring in the movie, and the movie would win or die on her performance. So I sent her to an acting coach in St. Louis, and then I did the more intense scene study with her over Skype and in person. And after 6 months of working really hard, she got good enough that I gave her the part. And then she continued to work and is fantastic in the movie.
This movie is pretty open about the changes that Ricky has gone through physically in her life, and the movie doesn't shy away from what Ricky's body looks like.
I wish I'd been born a genetic girl. I do plan on getting the full surgery someday. It's just so expensive. But for now, I might as well just dance with the one that brung me, right? And it's not really about hating my body, so I've learned to live with it.
And do you like keep it a secret that you...
Oh, no. I am completely comfortable with who I am, and I like to make sure everybody else in my life is too. So, you know, whether it's a boy or, like you, a new friend, if for any reason it should or does come up, I mean, I just get it right out in the open.
Was that difficult for Michelle to adjust to, given that she hadn't done this kind of acting before?
It was very clear to me for this particular story that character, you know, for reasons that are very endemic, very organic, very beautiful, very loving, very positive and supportive in the story of the film, needed to have a certain level of nudity. I think it's super important and in no way exhibitionist, in no way exploitative. It's the opposite. So from the beginning, I said, listen, you've read the script. And she just agreed with me completely. And quite honestly, in a greater sense, she really feels that it's important to... the whole sort of cause, meaning the whole transgender rights issue and demystifying and demythologizing and breaking down some of the false ideas that people have. So I think that she viewed it as from what she said publicly and privately to me, that she viewed it as something that was as equally important to the film as I did.
I want to play a little clip that gives people a sense of Ricky's personality and her sense of humor in this movie.
So how do y'all know Francesca? Were you away at school together?
Oh, no. I just met her in town. I went to school here, actually.
Oh, so you know David, her fiancé, then?
I didn't really know him.
God, high school in this town. Who can survive it?
Isn't it the truth? I was fat.
I had terrible acne.
And I was a boy, so that sucked.
Eric, you know, Ricky does use a lot of humor to get through her life. In the film, though, she also has a lot of support. Her father is very supportive. Robbie has been a great friend to her whole life. It doesn't necessarily seem like at least the portrayal of what you hear a lot of transgender kids going through. And Ricky certainly has her struggles as well. But there's a lot of good in her life. Why was that important to you to portray?
Well, you know, I did a lot of research. Well, and by a lot, I mean, I researched as much as I could when I was writing the script. I really believe that when you write from the heart, that's something that crosses and cuts across all gender, age, race, religion lines, sexual orientation lines. But I did want to make sure that I wasn't off base in any way, as best I could, with an organic transgender girl's, 22-year-old transgender girl's experience. So I interviewed as many transgender women as I could find during the auditioning process, and certainly once Michelle was cast, you know, I vetted the script with her. You know, and also wanting to turn every cliche I could on its head in this film. I think it's safe to say that Northeastern cities have less bigotry than some cities, some towns in the South still. I don't think that I'd get much of an argument on that. But it is absolutely untrue to say and unfair to say that rural America doesn't have massive pockets of people who are extremely loving towards everybody in their communities. So that was one stereotype that I actually found to be very untrue in some of the transgender women, including Michelle, that I interviewed, that were from Virginia, that were from Missouri, that were from small towns. And they said, you know, I was wonderfully, pleasantly surprised when I said, were you bullied? Were you beaten up? And they were like, not really. Like, you know, I have a great family that supports me and a little brother. And I, like, you know, I deliver pizzas at the store. And, you know, when I was in, that's my job. Or when I went to college, in high school, I dated the football players. Like, they really reported a lot of quote unquote normal kind of circumstances in their lives. And so that was great. And I did want to sort of portray that. Obviously, you know, that's not every trans person's story. I interviewed 6 or 7 or 8 trans women. So that's a small, extremely small cross-section of that community, but at least it was a start. And there seemed to be a lot of similarities in that there was a lot of love and a lot of support. So in trying to portray a transgender woman's story, I wanted to show that. And again, Michelle agreed with me. She's like, it's so great to just have a movie where, God forbid, the transgender character is not a prostitute, not a, you know, a criminal, not in prison. Not that those stories can't be told in a way that makes it a valid and important film or TV show. Of course not. I mean, Orange is the New Black is a great show. And so Laverne Cox's character is incarcerated. But I'm just saying, mm-hmm. To show a transgender woman in a positive light with a community and family that love her, I think was very important and not completely at all untrue to many, many transgender people's experience.
The movie takes place in Kentucky, but certainly sharp-eyed Vermont watchers will notice that the Jamaica Coffee House, for one thing, where Ricky works, seems to feature a lot of Vermont peanut butter products. And there's a scene in which a car drives by and what looks like a Vermont license plate, not the blue license plate of Kentucky. You did quite a bit of filming in southern Vermont.
I did, yes. And you're the one member of the audience out of 150 that is the continuity buster and talks about the license plate. No one's brought up the peanut butter. That is an eagle eye that you own the big prize for. But, you know, and there's a saying in the film business, if they're looking at that, they're looking at the exit sign, you know, in the theater.
Oh, well, but I certainly wasn't.
I know you weren't. And I'm just saying that I know that it's, you know, people have brought it up luckily, most people don't notice that. And, you know, hey, the father's in the movie, his character's a mechanic, so he could be working on cars that have license plates from all over America.
Sure.
But yes, the reason I shot in Vermont was because when you make a low-budget movie, you have to exercise every possible penny-pinching thing you can to make the film. And since I have a house in Vermont, and I've shot, actually, this is the third of my 9 films I've shot predominantly in Vermont, I figured rather than trucking everybody down to Kentucky, you know, it'd be a lot easier and much cheaper. And the community was so super supportive and generous to help us get the film shot there that's why I shot in Southern Vermont. And geographically, it approximates Kentucky really well with the beautiful low rolling hills and streams and horses. And so to the average viewer, there's absolutely no misunderstanding of sort of geographically where the film takes place.
Eric Schaefer is the filmmaker behind Boy Meets Girl. Eric, thank you so much for talking with us about the film.
Thank you. I really appreciate you taking the time and having the interest, Jane. It was terrific.
Boy Meets Girl will be available on demand and on DVD next month. We have a link to the movie's website at vpr.net. And that wraps up today's show. Tomorrow, House Speaker Shap Smith will be here to provide an update on some of the major bills in the legislature, including the sugar-sweetened beverage tax and school funding. We'll also look at where we stand at closing the budget shortfall. You can send questions or comments for Speaker Smith to vermontedition@vpr.net and listen tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Steve Zind, with production assistance from Aaron Lucy. Alex Keefe directed the program, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.